Good morning. Welcome to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I am your host, Nick Schott. Happy to have Captain John Hossie here with me today. John, how are you this morning?
Yeah, doing great. Thanks. Good to be here.
Absolutely, man. That John, if you don't mind, would you tell everybody a little bit about yourself, your background, how you got here, and and what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, happy to do that, Nick, and thanks for the opportunity to tell that story. So I've been in the Navy for 23 and a half years, thrill of a lifetime. Really kind of knew out of high school that's what I wanted. Went to the Naval Academy from there into my current profession, which is explosive ordnance disposal. You can think of that as how does the Navy deal with a unexploded ordnance, whether it's on land or underwater. The underwater part is really unique to what we do in the EOD community. And part of what makes my job just a dream come true, I feel like I get to live out every kid's fantasy, and particularly mine, right? To go out and to do this mission, to be able to dive underwater and find these things, to travel the world, to have gone to war, and to see what this looks like in real life. And that's just been a thrill for me. In the last 5 years, I decided that in my career, I'd like to pursue program management within the Department of Defense, which led me onto the current track that I'm in, still as an EOD officer, but also as a program manager now. And what that allows me to do is take a look broadly across the defense tech industry. And within my program, I have underwater robotic systems. We have, the largest constellation of underwater robots in the Navy. Ground-based robotic systems, which you can think about tools used to render safe and deal with explosive hazards on land. And then some emerging technology in the unmanned aerial, the uncrewed aerial systems part of it, drones, and how we can use to rapidly detect, large, within large areas that we're looking for ordnance items and to deal with and remediate those effectively. And so what I do is I have this incredible team here of mostly federal civilian program managers, warfare centers who have some of the best technical experts in the world in this subject matter, and then a number of companies that we work with. And I get to put all of that together in a way where we deliver to the Navy what they need in order to keep people safe and do this incredible mission. And it's just been the thrill of a lifetime. So yeah, I really enjoy it.
John, first, man, thank you for your service and for leading this such an important program. One of my good friends was he when he was active duty in the Army was EOD as well, and he's some of the thing if he was attached to the Rangers and like went into Afghanistan in 01, and just really, really good dude. But he's told me some of the stuff and what folks like yourselves do on a day-to-day basis. And so I have just the utmost respect for not only your decision to serve, but your choice to go into EOD specifically.
Yeah, thanks for that. Obviously, that's a very special unit. Your friend's clearly a talented and gifted person to be assigned to that unit. And so, yeah, the stories that you would have heard from them are probably as good as they get. But to be honest, during that period when we were in war and conflict, everybody who signed up was putting themselves in a position to do that. Some of us, like myself, were lucky enough to get the opportunity to go over and participate in combat operations. Others were on the standby in my mind. They're all equally heroic. So thank you for acknowledging them. Maybe just take a minute now for me to acknowledge the larger community of people, both active duty and retired, who served during that time. And for the folks now who are continuing to sign up and serve for what is going to come next, and who knows what that is. So I just say to any listener out there who's interested, the Navy's an amazing place to serve, and there's incredible communities where you can find your niche. So that's something you're interested in. I encourage you to pursue it.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate that, man. And so, Jeff, for folks that don't understand and don't know, can you explain, a little bit about how EOD is done now and what goes into that and like the day-to-day of, somebody that is, disposing of bombs and disposing of ordnance?
The interesting thing is that it's done much in the same way it's been done when I was a lieutenant years and years ago. And you could think of some maneuver unit, whether they're a Navy ship, another Navy platform, a soldier, a Marine, an airman, who's going into their battle space and cannot proceed where they would like to go because of some explosive hazard. Now, in the past, these explosive hazards we were worried about were improvised explosive devices largely, but you could think of munitions that may have been placed there, or an incoming threat that is hindering our ability to go where we want. And so it all starts with the problem of a unit needs to go from point A to point B and can't do it because there's an explosive hazard. At that point, the EOD community is called into action. And what would happen is you have to first understand what that threat is and do a threat assessment of the area. So this is where the problems start to get really interesting. Where are you at? What is around you? What is possible? What are your range of options, right? This is where the EOD community is really creative problem solvers, is because no two problems are the same in the real world in this regard, having been there. And so you first start with an assessment of the scenario. And from there's a number of options to you that are available based on what the conditions would permit and what the operational scenario would require. If you need to get a unit through in 5 minutes, that's a very different scenario than if you have a day to get a unit through. And so you have to take all this into account. At that point, you have to understand exactly what hazard you're dealing with. And honestly, this is probably the hardest part of the problem, when you're looking at explosive remediation, because in many cases, you will see one thing, but there will be many more threats in that area. So you have to do an assessment and really do your best to understand that all the threats that are present. And you have to assume that what is first presented to you by the people who found these explosive hazards is probably not the full story and maybe inaccurate, because when you're under stress and have a short period of time and you notice something that really spikes your adrenaline, it's hard to be very accurate. So then you have to understand exactly what you're dealing with in terms of the ordnance items. At that point, you would have to go and find what the correct procedures are, what the safeties are. And this is really a process that's done one of two ways. The first is via remote robotics. And this is a process that is still, even though it's enabled by robotic systems, is done in a very manual sort of way, in terms of you're controlling all of the movements of the robot at this point, and a skilled robot operator is able to maneuver through dealing with ordnance items. The other way that you can do this is there's personal protective equipment, big suits that we'll wear, and you basically go down and put yourself right next to this hazard, and here's where the job gets really exciting. And then you'll conduct some procedures that put you at close range with special tools that are designed to remediate that explosive hazard. And so it's all really situationally dependent on what you want to do and what tools are available, what information you have, as well as the larger context in which you're working. If you're going to do one of these specialized tools, you'll have an expected result of what you're going to do. You would then perform that procedure. You would then assess the situation in the larger context, and you would provide that assessment to the maneuver element you're supporting. At this point in the past, what me and my team used to do would be that you would then traverse through that area first. That's not necessary, but that was sort of the last step in the process for my team way back in the day. And that was just something that helped us sleep better at night, because we wanted to make sure that if we were telling someone it was safe to go through this area, that they believed it was hazardous, that we were the first people to go through. Because my biggest fear, when I used to do these operations, again, way back in the day, is that in my rearview mirror, I would see that we missed something. And so I always thought it would be better for us to go through first and make sure that the area was actually clear. And so that was the last part of it. But yeah, and so underwater, it's basically the same idea, but you are really hyper enabled by robotic systems at this point. And so you would search with an underwater robot, you would conduct procedures with a different underwater robot. This becomes a bit more challenging and nuanced because it's harder to see, it's harder to identify, it's more challenging. Some of these tasks are a bit more challenging underwater. And so, as anybody who's been underwater before knows, just scuba diving, everything underwater is challenging because of buoyancy issues, and it's hard to see, and it's difficult to use tactile senses, and it's no different with robots, right? It's just more challenging.
Absolutely. And also, I mean, is there a say there's, you're setting off one of these, explosive devices. Is the fact that it's underwater, does that change how the explosion, like, does it change the physics of the explosion, or does the shockwave travel differently through water than it would through, out in open air?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. The physics of the explosion itself are no different underwater than on land in the sense of what's happening inside the munition with the explosive fill. What is different is what happens in the surrounding area. There's a shockwave in both cases. Air and water are both fluids. And so, in some ways, the shockwave even propagates in similar ways. But the way that the force is transmitted, what happens in terms of phase change, if you think about like water to water vapor phase change, because of a hyper-energetic event that then turns water into water vapor. That's unique underwater as well. And there's also some additional hazards if a human being is underwater because of the way the pressure is transferred through the water into some of the cavities in the human body. So there's specific safeties that you have to be really cognizant of. But the physics of the event itself, the explosion, would be no different. It's just how it's transmitted through the air or water, what some of those safeties are. And this is where Navy EOD is a little bit different in that we get some additional training on how to understand and to mitigate those. Ideally, there's no human beings in the water, and we're dealing with robotic systems and ships and other platforms. And so it's also important for us to understand sort of what those safeties are and how that would look to deal with underwater explosive hazards.
Absolutely. And also, having seen a lot of let's just say recent combat footage out of Ukraine, and just seeing that the incredibly increased usage of drones compared to previous is compared to previous conflicts, and just the popularization of that technology, has are there is there are there different, like, is are combating those drone-based systems, is that fall under EOD, or is that different? And also, how would you approach that, where it's moving and things like that, if they do fall in your area of expertise?
Yeah, interestingly, my program covers both the robots we talked about as well as some of the EOD tools we talked about. But I have a number of programs, and one of them is a program that is it's called Drake. It's designed to counter uncrewed aerial systems, drones. And that program is really quite effective, actually, in dealing in a non-kinetic way with some of these drone threats that we have. And so I'm really, really proud of that system. As a matter of fact, in the last week, two Navy ships used that system effectively in order to provide a bubble of protection. And so what we're finding is, just as you pointed out, this is a proliferating threat that's being enabled by the commercial market largely, and that the operations in the Ukraine and through what's being reported in open source media seem to indicate that there's a lot of iteration and adoption of this technology in the combat operations that are happening. It's certainly been a key capability in other conflicts we've seen globally, so we're very aware of that. And we're really proud that our system, the Drake, is effective against many of these targets and is providing some bubble of capability against the threat. Now, the great thing about that system is it prevents the drones from ever making it to their target, right? So you don't have the problem of, hey, what if it lands on a ship? What if it lands on your base? Now what? So the best thing is just to keep it from landing. And so we're part of that network of supporting that. But okay, to your more directly to your question, let's say that it does land or it does something. And I think what we're seeing now, again, just from what I'm reading in the media and open source, is that a lot of times it's delivering something. It's not landing and posing the threat itself. So if it's delivering something, the threat that it delivers is what you have to deal with. Let's, say it's an explosive item that's dropped and it doesn't explode, and now it's in the middle of your base or on a road, right? It just becomes another pretty problem to deal with. But if the whole drone lands, then, obviously that's a pretty complex problem and one that my community has been thinking of for some time and developing some tactics in order to approach and deal with. But in some ways, it goes through that same flow of understand the threat, understand the environment, understand your tools, mitigate the threats as much as you can. And then, I don't think we're ever going to get to a spot where we replace human bravery. And I've just been so proud of my community and seeing what this generation of officers and EOD techs has, and operators has done in terms of having the physical courage to move forward into these threats in order to clear them and deal with them in a way that is amazing, right? And so that'll just continue to happen. So yeah, we're thinking about what that means. We're dealing with those. There's tools to do that. And again, the best thing is just to prevent them ever from arriving. So really proud of the work that we've done.
Yeah, it's that's awesome. It's really that's really cool. I appreciate you, kind of telling a little bit about the Drake system and because I it's I think I'm a student of like military history at large, John. And as you look at large conflicts and things that and like different technologies that change how, like the physics of the battlefield and the battle space. And obviously the high ground is and always has been a huge piece, but it has been a huge advantage no matter what conflict you're engaged in at any point in history. But you look at ways to increase to change that. And obviously drones are a way, a cheap, effective way to strategically change who has the high ground. And again, it's just I find all of this fascinating, like from a historian and from a historical perspective. It's just really interesting.
I totally agree. I'm going to make a quick comment, though, about something I heard you just say, that drones are a cheap way to enable this capability and this ability to do things remotely. At the moment, that is the proliferating capability, and they are low cost. So I'm not disagreeing with that part of it. And I'm going to say yes, and this same threat isn't just going to be on the low end. These uncrewed, autonomous, AI-driven remote or independent systems are going to be on the high end also. It's just we haven't seen that emerge yet. My prediction is that this capability will proliferate from the low end all the way to the high end. And again, that's just me projecting into the future. And there will be a moment, and I don't know what that moment is, but it'll be the same kind of moment when the military realized that an airplane could sink an aircraft carrier. I think it was Billy Mitchell, right? And the lights turned on and a paradigm shifted, and we realized it was a first-class citizen. And I don't know what the moment will be for robotic systems that have that, but at some point in the future, the capability will get good enough and there will be something that happens that will be a moment like that, where people won't think of this capability as a cheap, easy, mass-producible way to do something. Right, it'll still be that, like you pointed out, and that's all true, but it will also be a first-class citizen that is, in some ways, maybe even more effective than alternatives. Right, we're not there yet; that hasn't happened, but I will not be surprised in the least when we have that moment, because, as you pointed out, if you look at the history of warfare, there have been punctuations in time where it really shifted dramatically and suddenly in a way that people weren't totally prepared for, and I think we're going to have a couple of those. I think these robotic systems will just be one of them, and who knows when that moment will happen, but again, I predict that it will be a thing and that we'll have it both on the low end and the high end of the warfare spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. I 1000% agree with you, and I think you start thinking about some of those moments when, we realized that battleships were very vulnerable to aircraft carriers and they could, but, and, you know, but with launching planes, you can, launch them from 40, 40, 50 miles away. And there's very little chance that the battleship would actually be able to, respond in kind in any way. And you look at how like the how naval power changed in World War, and it was World War II, right? Early World War II. I think there were a couple of engagements. I think one in particular that I'm thinking of was a British battleship in like in Indonesia somewhere. With was sunk by a Japanese carrier for the cost of like a couple of airplanes, right? And when you start talking about trading assets in the in warfare, because a lot of it is that, and you start looking at well, of course I'll trade a couple of airplanes that I can replace tomorrow in my factory for a ship that you're going to take 3 or 4 years to build a replacement for. It's just fascinating.
The interesting thing is that every advance we've had in the military has gone through something like that. One of my favorite stories is the Battle of Mobile Bay for just a number of reasons. That was David Glasgow Farragut leading that assault on the Mo on Mobile Bay during the Civil War. And I did some study there because I thought it was so fascinating, the approach they took and how they dealt with the mines that they encountered. And so I learned that the Tecumseh, the leading ship that was sunk, was not where Farragut was on. He was on, I think it was the Hartley or Harvard, Hartford. It was the Hartford. And that was actually a wooden ship. The Tecumseh, the ship that sank, which was the first in that formation, was a Ironside. And so you're looking at a mixed fleet where the Navy hadn't come to realize that the Ironsides could and would be more effective. And so there was these mixed fleets. And the really interesting part about that story, just as a side note, is that Farragut is famous in the Battle of Mobile Bay for commanding his fleet forward after the Tecumseh was sunk very quickly by the first mine, because all the ships had stalled, the assault was stalled, and it's this moment of great bravery that we celebrate in the Navy. Matter of fact, it's on the stained glass of the chapel in the Naval Academy. He's like the seventh ship in the formation, though, on the Hartford. And so I didn't realize that. They don't tell you that when they tell you the story. So I was like, oh, come on. You're like, that's not as brave as I thought. Turns out that the caveat, even to that, is that the Hartford, the ship he was on, had the most casualties of any of the ships in the Battle of Mobile Bay. So it's not actually a critique of him. It just happened that that's where he put his command and control ship during the assault and the battle that happened at Mobile Bay. But yeah, so you look at the paintings of it, because I was really curious to see it, to understand it, and to get a bit more of the insights. Actually, just a bunch of interesting things about that battle. The CO of the Tecumseh, Commander McCraven, actually allowed his pilot to leave the ship, and as a result, didn't make it out himself so that he could spare the lives of one of his crews, not realizing, I think, how quickly the ship was going to sink. Just incredible bravery, even after they hit the mine. And to look at what Farragut did on the Hartford, how they advanced and how they had this mixed fleet of wooden and iron ships, where they like they maneuver so differently, they fight so differently, but the Navy just hadn't figured that all out yet. And so just as we made a transition into and out of battleships, into and out of steam, into and out of metal ships, from wooden ships, into and out of airplanes, or into airplanes, we're still in that, and all the other things, there's this transition of capabilities in the military, and it's always interesting to see the spikes when those changes happen, because they're pretty abrupt.
Absolutely. And it's always interesting to see, like, and to your point about wooden ships and iron ships fighting together, right? It's interesting to watch the turning points, right? And I think, like, World War One is obviously a massive, massive turning point, and how people went to war with, like, red hats and blue coats on and no helmets and just and how everything changed over that time. And again, just watching the transition and the changing in real time is absolutely fascinating from a military historian, from a his like again, as a military historian and from that perspective, it's just really cool to watch it and then watch the folks in real time, like people like yourself in the command structure and people and folks on the ground deal with and adapt to the transitions in real time, because the like I'm always fascinated by the human element involved in warfare, always, always.
And it's not done. I mean, not by a long shot. If you look at these massive peaks of transition and innovation that happened in warfare, just look at the pace at which technology is accelerating now. It's breathtaking how quickly things are changing and how much we're advancing. And we're becoming hyper-enabled by tools like AI that are going to allow us to make more and better advances quicker and faster. And so the pace that these changes are going to happen at is just increasing. And it is a very central and important thing for us to make sure that we are able to adapt and change as fast as the technology does to retain competitive advantage. So agility, strategic agility, operational agility, technology agility, contracting agility, test and evaluation agility are all going to be central to us doing that moving forward. So I'm really excited about all that.
Absolutely. And so how, obviously you brought up AI right just now. How does that play a role in EOD operations now, and has it changed things yet?
There has been an enormous amount of change as a result of AI so far, and it's only going to become more profound as we move forward. If you look at the ability to do pattern recognition using machine learning, we've been investigating this for a long time, and we've been able to operationalize this capability. Underwater is the most important area to get this right because it's so hard to see. And to get human beings underwater to do this activity, that robotics underwater are really a critical part of that. And what we found is that we're able to train AI in a machine learning based way where we can show it many patterns of what we're looking for versus what we're not looking for. And by doing that, it's become excellent at pattern recognition. And by being so good at pattern recognition, we've gradually, and in I think a thoughtful way, implemented AI so that at first it became a tool that once all the information was brought back from the mission, an AI assistant would help a human being review it and not miss important things. Okay, so like in the medical field, radiologists are using AI in order to not miss important things in imagery and healthcare information, right? Doctors are using it as aids for some of the work that they're doing. In finance, it's being used as an aid in many cases for decision making. And so we found the same thing is that the first and easiest approach to using AI for EOD work was as a decision aid, where the human being would still be doing the same work, really in much the same way. It would just have a tool there that could help point out things it should really pay attention to. And you could think about this as if you had an expert over your shoulder saying, did you notice that in the upper left-hand corner of this image, right? And so this is where you're getting some prompts, you're getting some places to focus your attention, and it's used after the mission as just a way to make the person better at doing it. Now, what we found is that as we improve our pattern recognition more and more and collected better data and more data, and we labeled this data and we made it available to teams, and we would then build multiple pattern recognition capabilities, and we would take them and we would integrate them so they would complement each other. That was really useful. We could get good enough where we could then put it on both the computer the human was using to review the information when we were done, and we could put it onto the robotic system that was underwater to help it do the mission it was assigned even better. And so that was the progression, was first to be used under very close supervision and cooperation as just a way to help humans, and then as it got better, as a way to help the robot gather better data to bring back to the human for their review as well. And underwater is great for this because, again, there's really no alternatives to, well, there are, but the robot is such a great way for us to do this search and to conduct this work and to gather this information that the more we can enable those underwater robotic systems to do the mission better, the more effective we make the humans who are reviewing the data. And so that's one way that it's changed what we do already. And there's a lot of things that I look at the roadmap of where we're going, where that's only going to become more robust. We're going to be doing that more on land. We're going to be using pattern recognition from other platforms, right, to spot things that we're interested in for in terms of explosive hazards. So I think the implications of this are incredibly profound over time. And if I were to say, where are we at with the full potential of what I think AI could bring to this mission set? We're very early. This is very early days. We are just starting to have, if this is the internet, we're just starting to build a few websites and like be able to peruse something. We are nowhere close to the full potential, I think, of what we could do.
Absolutely. And I think well, first, thank you. I really appreciate that. I think that you're absolutely right. It's very early days, and it's fascinating as you start looking at as you dig into a lot of what you said as it relates to not only training people, right, but then having this central repository for all of that data that is tagged and labeled that you're using to build, but then also putting it in and putting it into robots, right? And that's something that I've always been fascinated by is like, if can we take some of these systems and like put them in a robot and have it essentially make decisions in real time to move to protect folks that are doing, like, whether it's ordnance disposal or firefighting or any of these, that how can we not replace humans but augment them to augment us to ensure, increase safety, but then also increase data, right? And access, accessibility. Obviously, you and I both know somebody that's been doing something for 10 years is going to be far more adept than somebody that started yesterday. And so, trying to narrow the t or I think there also is a big opportunity to increase training and speed training up to increase the effectiveness of personnel more quickly.
Yeah, Nick, that's a great point and one that I've thought about a lot. And I think there is an incredible incredible opportunity to use AI to increase the efficacy of training as well as your operational performance. And as I look at what's possible, I imagine a future in which when you go through training, you have your own personal smart assistant, an agent who knows as much as is possible in terms of pattern recognition and as much, I'll use quote marks here, understanding of your job and the environment you're doing it in and the publications that govern it and the safety rules and all the things you need to know. And it's with you through training the whole time as your agent. And by agent, I just mean, an AI tool that is capable of interacting with you in a way that is useful and serves to make you a better performer of your job, right? So that's what the agent is. That agent then becomes persistent over time. So I don't see it as just a training tool, right? Because in the ideal version of this future that I'm painting, that agent understands everything that you went through in training. And because it helped you understand the key concepts, it might know that for concept A, you got it, first time, every time, and you are very good at concept A. But concept B took you a lot of prompting and rework with the agent to really understand what was happening for this concept that's related to your job. So it'll train you on how to do that. But the odds are that over time, it'll be more difficult for you to do concept B that you struggled with in training than concept A in the real world. So this agent persists with you onto your job and is available to you. And when you're going to do your job and it's related to concept B, maybe right before you get to the job site, your firefighter example, as just an illustrative here, it reminds you, hey, don't forget to do A, B, and C and to watch out for thing X, Y, and Z, because it remembers that you had a hard time with these things in training 4 years ago and nobody else knows that about you, only your agent. And so I see this training agent, which I agree with you, as an incredible opportunity to make training more effective. A way to have a persistent agent that makes you more effective in training, but also becomes like the perfect coach for you on the job so that your on the job performance is, I don't know, 20, 40, 70% better than without it because it knows you so well and can prompt you just in time every time.
1,000%, and you know, and I mean, 20% better would be amazing, but you like we know that a lot of people, if they're just, you know, 5, 10, 15% better, like that say, you know, in jobs like what you do, and you know, the firefighters, that saves lives, right? That has a real direct cost in human life and in pain and suffering. And I mean, one of my ventures is in the mental health space. I run a mental health company as well. And so that saves. And then when you start talking about that system being overburdened by preventing people from ha going through traumatic events, you're helping to ease the burden in systems like that. And you have to think about all the downstream effects that are potentially going to happen if we save lives and say, you know, and help people live, you know, help people not have to deal with all of the trauma that comes from either, you know, getting hurt in a fire or, you know, or having a bomb go off either underwater or in the air, and having it affect and hurt, affect people and hurt people.
It's
So it's
really interesting that you mentioned that. One of my family members was really using a lot of generative AI to help with some education and training, and as a result, became very comfortable interacting with it. This family member has fine social skills, is integrated to a social support network that's supportive. I don't want to give the impression that they're just alone by themselves with an AI agent all day long. But at one point, I was talking to this family member, and they said, at this point, I'm beginning to think that this AI agent knows me better than anybody else. And this is somebody I've lived with for a very long time. And I was shocked. And I came to realize that because they had interacted with this agent for so much, it knew them so well and was so able to respond to them both without judgment and without its own emotional baggage, that it felt like a really strong connection. And so I think your comment about mental health are, again, we're at the beginning stages of that, where as these agents become smarter and more relatable, more emotionally engaging, and have a better persistent memory of the things that you have said and who you are. I mean, there is a real upside and an advantage to being able to unburden some of the medical system, perhaps, and to provide just support for people to live a better life. And with that, obviously, there's a danger as well. And I think a lot of folks are highlighting that danger when it comes to interacting with these AI agents, that if it starts to impede on your social network, if it disconnects you from other real human beings, right? That's a warning sign we need to be watching for. But on the plus side, I had this experience of a family member who felt deeply connected to this autonomous AI agent that had been so helpful to them. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's a great comment.
Absolutely. And I think that I mean, your point is well taken about if it replaces a social network. I've seen some stuff online and I think in a couple of papers, either New York Times or The Washington Post, as it relates to AI friends, right? So systems that are set up to be a friend and talk, and then AI either girlfriends or boyfriends. And I think that's going too far. And like, I understand, there's an epidemic of loneliness in this country, especially amplified by COVID. And I think that and the lockdowns and people needing to stay inside for a couple of years. And you look at that combined with social media and what it's done over the last 15 years to, or 15 to 20 years to people's ability to interact and actually have a conversation and continue to enforce the downward trend of social skills that is unfortunately all around us now. And you look at like it's just so devious. And then obviously I mean, like the things that I think about is like imagine somebody with a clearance is has one of these AI friends or girlfriends, or and like think about this like potential security risks, but then what does it do to the individual and their and their self-esteem, and how does it reinforce that, and also how does it continue to perpetuate a warping of how interpersonal relationships actually work with a give and a take when the system is set up to just do whatever you want.
100%. And I'll just use your platform to maybe do a little public service announcement here. If any of your listeners are having a hard time, there are tons of resources to help connect. I think there's a lot of data around, I think it's the Harvard Happiness Study, that showed the number one indicator of someone's happiness and contentment in life is the number and quality of the relationships, connections they have. And if anybody's struggling with how to do that, it takes a little bit of bravery. You have to reach out to somebody. You have to propose doing something. And the more time you spend together and the more activities you do with others, be nice and listen a lot, and you're going to develop a big, broad social network that will make your life amazing. And if you need any help with that, there's a ton of great resources. In a Nutshell has this great YouTube video. It's my favorite channel about how to make friends. I've done it with all my kids. It continues to inform how I think about relationships. And what I just say is relationships are worth it. So if you find yourself struggling with that or feeling lonely, there's a lot of good resources out there, and you can change that in a heartbeat. My dad is in his 70s, joined an adult baseball league. He just went down to Arizona for a tournament, got invited down. And at 70, he has more friends and more activities in life than I have ever seen him have in the past. He's happier and flourishing in a way that is inspiring to me. And he did all of this because choosing to do activities with other people in his 70s that he enjoyed. And I will tell you, if my dad can do it, you can do it. And if it's as easy as joining a baseball league, there's some league you can enjoy as well. So it's worth doing. And yeah, there's a lot of great resources out there to encourage anybody to pursue that who's interested in it.
1,000%, John. I appreciate that. You hit on something. It absolutely takes, like, the first step is the hardest part. Like, we all, like, and opening that door. But when you do, and this has just been my experience with it, is that it's never as scary as you thought it was going to be. And you're, and your head, makes, helps amplify things. And your brain and your mind and how you think about things help amplify things. So it is scary, but it's never as scary or as big or as serious as you think it is, and as you build it up to be in your mind. So I absolutely agree. Reach out for help if you need it. Appreciate that, John. Thank you, man. And
You know, the
on.
funny thing is, I do this exercise, and I would encourage anybody, even if you have a social network that you love and you feel is sufficient, I do this exercise to inoculate myself against this fear of others and of asking. And so, if this is useful, make it part of your practice. If not, you go ahead and ignore it. But I try every day to ask somebody for something I think they'll say no to. This could be on an airplane, ask for the whole water bottle instead of a glass of water. They're not supposed to give it to you, so they're probably going to say no. Asking people routinely for things that you expect no's from allows you to be more courageous, and asking other people for things you really want, when it really is on the line, it builds that skill, it builds resiliency. It shows you that when someone says no to you, it's not a rejection of you, it's just a no to your request. And that sometimes you'll be the dog who caught the school bus and somebody will say yes to something to you. And I've probably had half a dozen of these in the last year where I've asked some outlandish thing from somebody in a powerful position and they've said yes to it. And I sort of just stare at myself like, what just happened here? And so, if that's helpful practice to you, that can also help you overcome this fear of reaching out to others or whatever that fear that you have. And so, yeah, encourage you that that's a way to build this muscle and strength around asking for things and being emotionally courageous in dealing with others.
Absolutely. John, I absolutely love that, man. I really do. I came up in sales, man. So hearing no all the time was absolutely part of it, and it is part of it. It's part of everything. You're going to get no's, you're going to get yeses, but if you don't ask, you're always going to get no's. And so, and amazing to your father for going out and investing in his life that way in his 70s and making it happen. That's inspiring.
I'm so proud of him. Yeah, and he's absolutely an inspiration. Thanks for saying that.
Absolutely, man. And back to our conversation around AI and the EOD world, John. Do you know about how many like do you understand? I know you guys really working on like military operations, but do you understand what is the humanitarian impact of unexploded ordnance in communities in the world? And can you explain to folks what the scale of that problem is?
I can absolutely. Thanks for bringing that up. Most people don't even realize that that's still a thing. Early in my career, I spent almost all of it in the Pacific Theater, stationed in Guam, Japan twice, Hawaii twice, and so have a ton of experience in some of these areas that have enormous amounts of unexploded ordnance still. I went to Vietnam twice. Beautiful, beautiful country, by the way. Absolutely amazing. Had left a little. It's a great place, and I really enjoyed experiencing the culture and seeing what it was actually like instead of what I thought it would be like, and it was amazing. But here's the thing: we were there to help with humanitarian operations, and there was so much ordnance and explosive hazards there that it was disorienting to me to see explosive, unexploded ordnance and parts of unexploded ordnance almost everywhere, to the point where you would go to a junkyard and there would be a whole section of scrap metal that was nothing but partially intact ordnance items, bombs that were left over from conflicts there. And it was so massive, and there was so much of it that I couldn't make sense of what I was seeing. And so I had to ask our colleagues from the State Department who we were working with, like, what is happening? Why is there bombshells and pieces of bombs everywhere? And they said, there is so much unremediated ordnance still that it is going to be a challenge for decades. It's just a massive issue to be dealt with still. And farmers would find things that would become unearthed. It would wash up in the water. It would be discovered by locals. And here's the really tragic part is that they would then recover it for scrap and turn it into these scrap yards. The problem being it didn't always go well. And so there's a lot of people still suffering in their local communities who might be primary income earners in really challenging economic conditions that might suffer some really serious injuries and not have great medical support and not have a safety net if they can't work, because of the local economy that's built up around recovering some of the scrap metal and the prevalence of it. And so it's still to this day just an absolutely massive issue to be dealt with. I remember one time there was a port that we went to in the Marianas that had been shut down because a World War II mine was discovered in one of the primary entrances to the harbor. And so they called our team out. And I looked underwater, and sure enough, it looked like it was right out of a World War II picture, storyboard, magazine, whatever, mine with the horns on it still sitting there, thankfully in this case in the bottom of the ocean. But we had to go in and remediate that explosive hazard. And so there is absolutely still a problem. There's in the Philippines, it's still an issue that I have friends who are actively remediating there. I haven't been to Europe, but I know there's an active community of people in Europe still dealing with a lot of ordnance that's there from the conflicts. And so ordnance never is 100% to detonate one drop. So you're always going to have some ordnance left. It can get buried in many cases because of the energy and the speed of impact. And what happens is it just takes years to surface. And so whether it's farmers or being washed up ashore, there is every day a lot of ordnance worldwide that's going to be discovered and continues to pose a hazard. And so, yeah, your point is well taken that there's a humanitarian component to explosive ordnance and remediating this because lives are impacted, people are affected every day, and it's going to be an ongoing issue for a very, very long time because of this. And so, yeah, my heart goes out to the folks dealing with that. And I'm so proud of the communities. And there are many communities that are trying to remediate all this and the great work that they're doing, but it's an ongoing issue.
Absolutely. And I'm and it's fascinating that there's so much ordnance in Vietnam. I'm a I've mentioned World War One a couple of times. I know that there are parts of France and parts of World War One battle, like where there's World War One battlefields where people just haven't been on them in 100 years because they're so dangerous because of the scale of the explosives. But then also, I mean, World War One, there's a huge scale of chemical warfare, and you look at chemical weapons, and then like that's a different conversation altogether. But there's been massive amounts of conflicts in Vietnam, and you think about the number of shells and bombs that were created in like World War II that are still out there unexploded, and absolutely hurting people every day. Can we use AI systems to either to help attack some of this problem, whether it's mapping them or like locations of them, or like is there a way, or how do you even begin to approach something like this?
Yeah, so a little bit outside of my direct expertise and what the program is dealing with. I don't have systems particularly doing that for the humanitarian things, but I'll say that I have friends involved in this industry, and that whether it's on land or underwater, there are parts of this bomb disposable community that is absolutely looking at those technologies and trying to integrate them in a way to map, locate, and dispose of these ordnance items. I don't know that I could give you a good assessment of how well it's working. But what I'd say is that, we are trying to do similar things within our programs and we're making progress. I would hope that the communities doing this in the NGO and the humanitarian assistance side of things are getting access to the same capabilities and technologies to improve what they're doing. But it would seem to me on first principles, right? If you're able to survey an area, look at signals, distinguish the signal from the noise, and perform pattern recognition with properly labeled data, you should be able to build algorithms and deploy these either into a post-mission analysis to help people review and find the ordnance items or to the robots themselves as they're doing the missions. So, from a first principles perspective, I don't think there's anything holding us up from doing that, but I'm not sure that I'm the right person to give you an assessment of the marketplace to see if that's been actualized yet.
I appreciate that, John. You're better, you're closer to it than I am, which is why I'm asking these questions, man. I mean, the last question I have for you is, we've talked a lot about AI, robots and AI systems, and how the two can work together to help, help, and how they can work together to help, dispose of ordnance in a more safe environment or in a more safe manner. But as we think about this, how do you balance the need for autonomy within AI systems, and as that continues to grow, with human oversight?
This really plays into the larger issue of trust and safety in AI. And this is a really complex and nuanced issue because the context in which you're deploying the AI is so important to answering this trust and safety question. Human oversight is one component of that. But in addition to, I think what you're really trying to get at is also things like explainability. right? Hey, AI, why did you say that this, why did you say X and not Y in this case? Explain why. I think understanding something called out of distribution data is important also. Hey, I think that this is what you're looking for, but I also know I've never seen something like this before, right? That's something that a human would really benefit from. I think also ensuring that your systems don't have bias is very important when it comes to this kind of work in terms of trust and safety. So, were you trained with trustworthy data? Were the labels done appropriately? Do we really trust the data that was used in this case? And I think there's a real question also about how generalized are the algorithms that you're going to use? Did you collect it all in situation A? Let's say in a flat sandy desert with no obstructions, but now you're going to try to use this algorithm in the woods, right? You would really want to know and understand that ahead of time. And so this is a really nuanced issue, trust and safety in AI, because it also depends based on the results of a negative outcome, right? So your level of oversight and your level of testing, your level of rigor, right? Like if this is a healthcare question, I'm absolutely going to want the FDA to really understand and to really provide some great oversight so that a medical procedure doesn't get messed up because of an algorithm or a bad diagnosis or a bad medication or prescription, right? And I'm going to want that algorithm to be locked down and never changed unless it's really thoroughly reviewed because of the implications. Now, in some contexts, the military is like that, where you just can't accept something going wrong. And so you're going to want to really thoroughly, slowly, and extensively test whatever algorithm you've built. You're going to want human oversight at every step in the process, setting up the test conditions, running the test in multiple environments, gathering the data, labeling the data, training the data, backfitting the data against what you didn't train it on, but you held back certain amounts of data. How did it do? And now take that algorithm and test it in every conceivable environment so it always works, right? That's one level that we probably need to have based on the severity of a negative outcome. Now, in other cases, the outcomes are much more tolerable if they go wrong. And the imperative is that you must move faster. So, in those situations, maybe there's a very minimal amount of human oversight involved, and you can just go really quickly through the whole thing. But it's hard to give sort of one approach to this question of trust, safety, testing, reliability, and bias without understanding with some real nuances and some sensitivities to the people and the implications. What would happen if there was a negative outcome? Alternatively, what would happen if we moved really slowly? Because all those things have to be weighed in a way that takes the technology, the situation, the threat, and the potential outcome into consideration. And I think that's a really nuanced and complicated issue that we're going to continue to wrestle with as a community implementing and building AI systems and algorithms into the foreseeable future, and one that's really worth our time. So I appreciate you mentioning that. I look forward to participating with a larger community about that conversation.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that well thought out answer, John. I think that you're 1000% right, that it, the amount of oversight depends on the, what on the use case, but there still needs to be oversight in, and it's going to be fascinating to see how it continued, this conversation continues to be to develop because it is so important. I think that, we're all grappling with it now and trying to figure out, really how much, like, if it's a chat bot on a website, that's a different conversation than if it's, involved in a military system or public safety in some way, right? I've had a lot of people on talking about public safety with AI because I think that that's absolutely fascinating. And I think, man, I think you, what you do and the programs you run are really, really cool. I think you're doing a lot of really, really fascinating cutting edge stuff, man. And I really appreciate you coming on to Robots and Red Tape and having a great conversation with me today.
Nick, thanks so much. It was an absolute pleasure. You're obviously very thoughtful in this domain. Appreciate getting a chance to be on your platform here, and I look forward to seeing what happens next.
Absolutely. Thank you for listening to Robots and Red Tape, everybody.